You are listening to Fees Always Wins, a financial podcast.
What's a rip?
A rip, commission. That's why we work here.
We make huge rips.
No, I still don't know how it works.
But you and me, the brokers, right, we're taking home cold hard cash via commission.
Right.
No matter whether our clients make money or lose money, the Duke and Duke get the commissions.
The only thing we don't know is your fee.
My fee is the free market. And you're part of it. Yeah.
Well, welcome back to episode 22 of Fees Always Win. We've returned with a new series of stocks and goals for the quarter, which we went over in the dividend. Ello is here. Chris is here. And today we're going to talk about retirement, or really things that are geared towards your retirement. What's a pension? What's a 401k? What's interest? As we keep talking about our previous stock picks and how they're performing versus our entry into the market, what should be the expectation of performance, or what does your money need to do for you? And those are some of the things we're going to go over today. You are listening to Fees Always Win Investment Club, hosted by Chris and Ello, two investors on a journey to learn more on strategy, indicators, and knowledge to become great investors. You can find us on Facebook, iTunes, and probably every other place you get your podcast. Call and leave a message on our voicemail line, 281-645-9205, and please leave a rating on our iTunes page. If it's 5 stars, we'll read it on the air. How you doing, Ello?
I am great. Our picks are coming together well. The show, we're up to 22 episodes, which I'm so proud of. We're really starting to get rock and rolling with everything. How are you, sir?
Man, I'm feeling that momentum, riding the wave.
The wave is going in the right direction. Yes, sir.
And actually, this is episode 23, so last one was 22. This is going to be 23, so we're moving up that chart.
23 episodes, and we're starting to get more followers, which is amazing in itself.
Yeah, we appreciate you for listening. If y'all have any topic ideas, please give us some feedback and directions that we could do more research to learn more. And we'll be happy to share with what we're learning. This is our open investment journal that we record our conversations. We do research each week to see how we could get better at this. And hopefully you're on the journey as well and trying to find out and take control and take agency in your own future. And this is going to be one way to do it. And so looking at interest, as we've been learning what the percentages of gains are and how to make the most money in it, and we know that fees, as that's the name of the show, Fees Always Win, that they're going to take a percentage of your interest, even when you're investing in 401ks or EFTs or ETFs. I mean, interest is going to be that money paid regularly at a particular rate for the use of money lent or delaying the repayment of debt. In this case, you're lending your money to a company or an organization, or even if you have it in the bank as a savings or checking account, you're giving permission for them to use that money as leverage to buy other products, make other investments, make other bets. So they're paying you for that right to do it.
Regarding interest, the big thing that you always hear people talk about is compound or compounding interest. And I just wanted to give a quick breakdown of what compound or compounding, they're basically the same thing, interest is. So compound interest is basically interest calculated on the initial principal and also on the accumulated interest of previous periods of a deposit or loan. It starts with originated in the 17th century in Italy. Compound interest can be thought of as interest on interest and will make a sum grow at a faster rate than simple interest. Simple interest is calculated only on the principal amount. Compound interest is the rate at which compound interest accrues, and it depends on the frequency of compounding. Compounding is the higher the number of compounding periods, the greater the compound interest. So the amount of compound interest accrued on $1,000 compounded at 10% annually will be lower than that of $100 compounded at 5% semi-annually over the same period. Regarding compound interest, most people want to know how it's calculated. They want to know how does the money work together, because why put your money in something if you don't know how the figures are adding up or how the things are coming together? So just to give a quick breakdown of compound interest, there's basically a formula that they go by. Compound interest is calculated by multiplying the principal amount by 1 plus the annual interest rate raised to the number of compound periods minus 1. I'm going to break it down. I know that sounds crazy, but the total initial amount of the loan is then subtracted from the resulting value. So compound interest is calculated by multiplying the principal amount by 1 plus the annual interest rate raised to the number of the compound periods minus 1. I'm going to keep saying it because it's very important. So let's get it like this. Total amount of principal and interest in future or future values less the principal amount at present. Let's say P is the principal and I equals the nominal annual interest rate in percentage terms, and N equals the number of compounding periods. Take a three-year loan at $10,000 at an interest rate of 5% that compounds annually. What would be the amount of interest? In this case, it would be $10,000 plus 0.5% minus 1. It would equal $10,000, and then you add the 1.157 minus 1. So overall, you'll see a growth of $1,576.25. I know I'm talking a lot of numbers, but breaking down compounded interest, you have to know the formula. You have to know the term of the interest, whether it's annually or semi-annually, to predict growth. Because the interest also takes into consideration accumulated interest of previous periods, the interest amount is not the same for all 3 years. Simple interest, it would be the same because it's simple and it's basically the same rate no matter what. Compounded interest is basically interest on top of interest, which makes a difference. While the total interest payable over the three-year period for this loan would be $1,576.25, the interest payable at the end of each year would vary based on the overall timeline. I don't know if that makes sense. I'm going to try and break down a little bit further and try and simplify it because I don't want to confuse anybody. Interest can be compounded on any given frequency schedule from daily to annually. There are standard compounded frequency schedules that are also usually applied to financial instruments. The most commonly used compounding schedule for a savings account at a bank is daily. Let's say you have a CD. A CD is a typical compounding frequency and is scheduled daily, monthly, or semi-annually. For money market accounts, it's often daily. Some banks also offer something called continuously compounding interest, which adds interest to the principal at every possible instant. For practical purposes, it doesn't accrue that much more than a daily compounding interest unless you're wanting to put money in and take it out at the same time. Basically, compounding interest is interest compounding on top of interest. You want to know how you want your interest to compound, whether it's daily, weekly, monthly, semi-annually, because that, using the formula we discussed before, kind of breaks down the amount that you can expect to see moving forward. The amounts you put in also affects the overall interest that's being taken out, but with the formula of compounded interest, you at least have an idea of the overall return you're going to get versus guessing or guesstimating. Let's say if you weren't familiar with the overall process.
And one of the things that you could use to measure how your interests are, how interest affects your investments directly, is the rule of 72. It's a simplified way of determining how long an investment will take to double given a fixed annual rate of interest. By dividing 72 by the annual rate of return, investors could get a rough estimate of how many years it'll take for an initial investment to duplicate. So the example is the current interest rate for a savings account is averaging around 2.8 right now. That if you put $100 in, you'll get $2.80 at the end of the year. So if you wanted to calculate how long it's going to take to get that money that money out, you would divide 72 would be divided by 2.8. It would take 25.7 years to double your money at that rate of interest. So it gives you an estimate or a longitudinal view of how much you're saving. But you're looking on compounding, as Ello indicated, that every time it calculates, it takes in that new calculation amount and how it's going to affect you going forward. And that's a strength or an ability there. And that's a way for you to save money, is looking at that and finding the best way to make the money work for you. And so look at what that rate is. If you're unsure, please find out. It's important to know what your money is doing and how it's helping someone else. Particularly is the concept of inflation. Inflation is defined as a sustained increase in the general level of prices for goods and services in a country. And it's measured as an annual percentage change under the conditions of inflation. The prices of things rise over time. Put differently, as inflation rises, every dollar you own buys a smaller percentage of goods or services. When prices rise, and alternatively, when the value of money falls, you have inflation. So think of all those gift cards, or think of anything that you have. The price of gas when you graduated from school. The price of gas when you graduated for school. For me, it was about $1.32, and I thought that was a whole bunch when I graduated high school. Now the price of gas is averaging $2.65. So inflation, by that calculation, is it about double. But that would be an incorrect way to assess it, as there's other factors that go on in gas. You have to look at the price of milk, the price of bread, the price of all consumer goods. In this case, there's two separate indexes that you could utilize: the consumer price index and the producer price indexes. The consumer price index, short CPI, is a measure of price changes in the consumer goods and services such as gasoline, food, clothing, and automobiles. The CPI measures the price change from the perspective of a purchaser. U.S. CPI data can be found at the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. Right now, that consumer price index is also at 2.8, the same as the savings rate. So if you're looking for your money to keep up with inflation, if you find yourself a 2.8 account, then that's going to be a good way to stay level with inflation, so your money isn't losing value by storing it in a pillow or under your bed. The other one is the producer price index, and short as PPI, a family of indexes that measures the average change over time in selling prices by domestic producers. This is from their perspective. The producers that are in the U.S. selling their goods, so farmers often go by this index, as well as commodity brokers or growers go by this index. And that rate they see is 3.1%. So if their costs of their goods aren't going up by 3.1% every year, they're taking home less money than they were the year before. That's going to be one thing we have to look at, as why you want to invest, because combined with compounding ratios, if the inflation index is up 2.8% every year and your money is under your saving money, you've saved $100,000 in 25 years, your $100,000 is worth much less than $100,000 because it's been there. Your $100,000 in that 25 years should be worth more as $200,000, which is why you want to invest it. But you have to take into account risk and losses, that the riskier the investment, the higher likelihood that there's variables and it could lose money. But you could get an investment like a IRA, which we talked about, which will guarantee you 3% to keep up with that inflation level. One way where companies try to protect their employees and give them guarantees so they could pay them less in the beginning were pensions. And they were regular payments made during a person's retirement from an investment fund to which a person or their employer had contributed during their working lives. You've heard this term. You might have heard this term from people in Detroit, and they said they started at the line at 18 years old. They worked there for 25 years. they're now retiring they're now retiring at 33 years old, and they're getting money every single year, $45,000. But that's a pension, and it secures income so somebody could survive as they retire in case they didn't just save enough money.
Right. And there's a prolonged history regarding pension plans. It goes back to 1875. The American Express Company established the first private pension plan in the United States. Prior to the 1870s, private sector plans did not exist, primarily because most companies were small, family-run enterprises. There's an entire section of history that shows different changes and how it affected pensions, because at one point in time, pensions were considered to be the way to go if you wanted to save and start to create wealth over time as you worked. That's why we're going over the main three that we're going over regarding pensions, regarding 401k, and then letting you know interest and compounding interest and how it all works together. 1921, the Revenue Act of 1921 exempted interest income on trusts for stock bonus or profit sharing plans from current taxation. Trust income was taxed as it was distributed to employees only to the extent that it exceeded employees' own contributions. The act did not authorize deductions for past service contributions. 1926, the Revenue Act of 1926, exempted income on pension trusts from current taxation. So you're going to see a line of different changes throughout the pension history and to how we got to the point where we are today. I'm not going to go through each one. I'm just going to give you an idea where it started to where we are now. You go to the point of 1940. You know what? 1935, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act. So in 1938, the Revenue Act of 1938 established the non-diversion rule and made pension trusts irrevocable. 1940, 4.1 million private sector workers, 15% of all private sector workers were covered by a pension plan. 1940, 4.1 million private sector workers. The Investment Advisors Act of 1940 required delegation of investment responsibilities only to an advisor registered under the act or a bank or an insurance company. So as we go along and people start investing more money, there's safeguards to protect employees put in place. So 1946, the United Steelworkers of America made pensions an issue in their strike against Inland Steel. At this time, the National Labor Relations Act did not cover pensions. Steelworkers Local 1010 in Indiana Harbor took the issue to the National Labor Relations Board. So in 1947, the Labor Management Relations Act, the Taft-Hartley Act, provided fundamental guidelines for the establishment and operation of pension plans. So then you start going into the 90s. I'm skipping over a bunch of different plans, but you go into the 90s. 1992, the Unemployment Compensation Amendments of 1992 imposed a 20% mandatory withholding tax on lump sum distributions that are not rolled over into qualified retirement accounts. Liberalized rollover rules are required plan sponsors to transfer eligible distributions directly to an eligible plan if requested by the participant. So in 1993, the Pension Annuities Protection Act clarified that in cases where a pension plan fiduciary purchases insurance annuities in violation of ERISA, ERISA rules, a court may award appropriate relief, including the purchase of backup annuities to remedy the breach. 1996, the Small Business Job Protection Act created the Savings Incentive Match Plan for employees. So what you see now is sometimes you have a company that matches what you put in. This is where we get that law from. This is 1996. Keep in mind, we started out in 1875. 1996, it created a new non-discrimination safe harbor, repealed Section 415, which limits and created a new definition of highly compensated employees. It modified plan distribution rules, repealed family aggregation rules, and made USERRA technical changes and required the SEC 457 plan assets be held in trust. 1996, we saw the source tax repeal, which amended the Internal Revenue Code to eliminate state taxation of pension income received by individuals who no longer reside in the state where they earned their pensions. So basically, we start to see a change in the way pensions were taxed, the way that they were treated, and we start to see a situation where companies could match what other employers are putting in. Regarding pensions, a lot of people are curious how they're calculated because they want to know how the money is put together. Most defined benefit pension plans use a formula that calculates three factors: the number of years of service of the employee, the final average salary of the employee, and a benefit multiplier. There is a percentage, often ranging from 1 to 2.5%, that determines the size of the benefit amount. So that's typically the history of pensions, and it shows how they are calculated. Now, we're starting to see a change in regards to pensions, whereas in the past, pensions were considered to be the way to go. And I guess it would be considered the more millennial age. You're starting to see people convert their pensions because they want to lower the taxes. One of the easiest ways to lower the taxes, you have to pay. A lot of people are converting their pensions to Roth IRAs. They find it different ways to move their money around versus the old school idea of creating a pension. Now they're creating more options to put their money in a position to gain more compounding interest and get more out of what they put in. So we're starting to see a change from people going into pensions into starting to believe in CDs, believe in Roth IRAs, and even taking out their 401k and putting things in stocks as well. So there's starting to be a shift regarding what used to be and what people are starting to want to do now that they have more information.
And just to kind of drive a little more perspective to the audience, is American employer-sponsored pension plans, as Ello indicates, date back all the way to the 1870s. And at their height in 1980s, they covered nearly half of all private sector workers, about 90% of public employees, and roughly 10% of private employees in the U.S. are covered by the defined benefit plan today. So just in less than 50 years, it's gone from half of all private sector employees to less than 10% of public sector employees.
Yeah, the biggest thing that you see with pensions, you see the change of how at one point in time, that was thought to be the main way to save money, the main way to have wealth when you retired. And now you're starting to see a swing into other avenues because of the different laws and different things that were passed that changed how it started to what it is now.
And so 401ks would be the next evolution of pensions. Originally, it's coined towards Ted Benna, and on his own website and on his article, he describes it as that he remembers the conversation well. It was a quiet Saturday afternoon during September 1979 when he was in his office. Co-workers were wandering into the office, and he wants people to know what's the myth and reality of what he actually did. The first myth is that he was sitting in his office reading the IRS code when he discovered this little gem that no one else found. Frankly, I don't know how that myth started, but it isn't true. Many people, including me, were aware of the portion of the IRS code that was used to design the first 401k savings plan. Because this provision was added to the code for an entirely different purpose, no one considered using it in the manner that I was to propose. It was, in fact, redesigned the retirement program for one of our bank clients. And at the time, he was a consultant and co-owner of the Johnson Companies, not to be confused with Johnson & Johnson, which many of the Wikipedia stories attribute it to. It was a small benefits consulting firm located in suburban Philadelphia. It was considered the bank's goals drawn back to Section 401k of the code. That's where it gets its name from. It's the IRS code. It's called 401k. The bank wanted to replace its cash bonus plans with the tax-deferred profit-sharing plan where employees wouldn't have access to the money until they left the bank. The president wanted to add this type of plan because they wanted a tax break and the bank needed the plan to be competitive in terms of hiring, as pensions were the drive, and that was an additional benefit that employees were looking for. Several years earlier, he designed it for another bank to do the same thing. At the time, the only option was to replace the entire cash bonus with a contribution to the plan to give the employees additional retirement benefits. Most of the employees weren't thrilled to have the cash bonus replaced by a plan that tied up the money for retirement. I didn't want it to happen again, so I pondered how to satisfy the president without getting most of the other employees ticked off. It was a bit of desperation that got it flowing, and I realized that it would become effective on January 1st, 1980, and that provided some hope. I could use this to design a plan allowing each employee to put in whatever portion of the cash bonus they wanted, and the only catch that I had to get a lower pay two-thirds to put in enough money into the plan to allow the top one-third to contribute as much as they wanted. So the beginning of this inception was how to get executives more bonus money tax-deferred that they didn't have to pay taxes to, and they had to twist the arms of the regular employees to make sure, as this was a big change from what previously was being put in directly by the company for their retirement. So they changed all these plans so the employees would be able to put it in pre-tax rather than after tax, which is where the real benefit's going to come from. That if you make $100,000 a year, you're allowed to put $18,500 in per year. And so you will ultimately only get taxed for $91,500 despite your income being higher than that. The end of the story, the bank rejected the idea because the attorney didn't want them doing something that's never been done before. As a result, the first plan that they did for was for their own employees at the Johnson Companies, and that's how they started the 401k revolution. What are 401ks? There's several types of 401ks available. The traditional is the Safe Harbor plan. There's the 401k plan, and then there's the simple 401k. Different rules apply to each for tax-favored status. A plan must be operated in accordance with the applicable rules. Therefore, it is important that the employer familiar with the special rules that apply to its plan so it's administered in accordance with those rules. To qualify for tax benefits available to qualified plan, a plan must both contain the language that meets certain requirements of the tax law and operate it with the plan tradition. For the everyday, it's a traditional plan. It allows eligible employees to participate in the plan to make pre-tax elective deferrals through payroll deductions. In addition, in a traditional 401k plan, the employers have the option of making contribution on behalf of all participants, making matching contributions based on employees' elective deferrals or both. These employer contributions could be subject to a vesting schedule, which provides the employees right to an employer contributions become non-forfeitable only after a period of time or immediately be invested. I have had this example happen in a previous organization where they would pay up to $18,000. They would pay. They would match half of everything I contributed. I attributed $18,000. They will pay $9,000. But the only way that I'm able to keep their portion is I have to remain with the organization for longer than 36 months. Being I left the organization before the 36 months, that means I technically lost about $18,000 if I paid that maximum amount, which is a big thing that you should probably read when you're onboarding at a new organization or with your current organization. See, is there a vesting schedule so you know what your options truly are, because you might be leaving money on the table technically.
Right. And with anything related to 401k, a big portion that everybody wants to know, they want to talk about benefits. They want to talk about how it's potentially calculated. They want to know how 401k is taxed. And like Chris said, there are different 401k benefits. It all depends on what benefits you choose. But 401k plans offer numerous tax benefits. First off, you can contribute a certain percentage of your income to a 401k on a pre-tax basis. In other words, the amount you contribute to your 401k is exempt from current federal income tax. So it lowers your taxable income. Contributions are made after an employee withholds taxes before the employee already paid taxes. He or she will not owe taxes on distributions. However, if an employee receives a company match on a Roth contribution, the company match is a pre-tax contribution. How much tax do you pay on 401k? Okay. With the $5,000 withdrawal, your gross taxable income grows to $40,000, which is in the 25% tax bracket for a single filer. So instead of paying 15% on $5,000, which would be $750, you pay taxes on $40,000. You calculate that by taking the first $8,700 of your income and multiplying it by 10, which would be $870. Just to give you an idea of how much tax you pay on 401k based on what's put in. Taxes on regular 401ks, the distributions on a regular 401k are taxed as ordinary income at the same income tax rate as your paycheck. The reason for this, as with traditional IRA, is that you contribute to a traditional 401k with pre-tax dollars, like we said before. One of the easiest ways to lower the amount of taxes you have to pay on a 401k is to convert to a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k. Withdrawals from those accounts are not taxed as long as they meet the rules for a qualified distribution. Be aware that you'll have to declare the conversion when you file your taxes. The big issue with converting your traditional 401k to a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k is the income tax you'll have to pay on the money you withdraw. If you're close to pulling out the money anyway, it may not be worth the cost of converting it. The more money you convert, the more taxes you have to pay. The longer the money can stay on the Roth before withdrawals begin, the better, says certified financial planner Daniel Sheehan of Sheehan Life Planning. Ben Wasik of Wasik Financial Planning, and this is from Investopedia, recommends splitting your assets between a Roth account and a tax-deferred account to share the burden. Although you will likely pay more taxes today, this strategy will give you the flexibility to withdraw some funds from a tax-deferred account and basically save money in the long run. So regarding 401k, you want to know how it's taxed. You also want to know there are benefits that come with it, but you want to have all of the information available to you to be able to move money around and make it work for you. A lot of people suggest Roth IRAs and Roth 401ks, but you also want to know about the conversion when you take the money out. Previously, I kind of linked 401k and pensions, but the pensions developed into what we now see as 401k, not the Roth IRA. Roth IRA is something that came, and most people do. You see it's interchanging with 401k, so I just wanted to clarify that from earlier.
Yeah, and one of the things is there's also a couple of other 401ks that I didn't go over outside of the Roth ones that are the simple 401k was created so small businesses could have an effective, cost-efficient way of offering retirement benefits to their employees. Simple 401k is not subject to the annual non-discrimination tests that apply to 401k plans. And there's also the Safe Harbor plan that means the employer is required to make employer contributions that are fully vested. And that's going to be the big difference is if it's fully vested, if the employee is with you for more than a year, then they have to have the benefit of that employment. They receive the benefit of their 401k contribution as an employer. The 401k plan can have an automatic enrollment feature, but one of the big things that you should realize with the 401ks is with managing your own plan is max out your employer contributions as you can. It'll save you money on the taxes on the back end, and it'll prepare you for savings for your retirement towards the end. Review your 401k brokerage investment options. Oftentimes, you're allowed to choose where that money is vested and what tradable assets or mutual funds that's being placed in, how much those mutual funds are charging fees, because you will lose a percentage of your 401k investment to fees naturally, but you could review what those fees are. Mostly, the more aggressive plans are going to have higher fees to go along with it. And the other option is to look forward to is if you've been to a couple of jobs, roll over your former 401k instead of cashing them out. If you cash them out, you will have to pay those taxes that Ello was indicating. But if you roll them over, they will be tax deferred and they'll go into your other account, and you'll get that compounding interest and your focused investments that you're getting from there. And the biggest one is, this is going to be the most efficient way to make your money, is that you're never going to find another investment that guarantees you 100% return or 50% return. So if you know that you're putting in $10,000 every year and the company agrees to match it, take that deal as you're getting $20,000 for the $10,000 you're investing. As an investor, that's all you want, is to guarantee the growth of your money, and that's one of the best ways to do it.
All right, and a big thing regarding compounding interest that Chris touched on before, that is interest on interest. So whenever you're getting into a situation where you have the opportunity to collect on compounding interest, that's something you want to look into. The main topics that we discussed, a lot of people with different employers, you've heard these terms before. You may be familiar with it, or you may have an idea of it, but this just gives you an idea of the overall history, how things are taxed, where your money's going, and gives you options that you may not have known about. Maybe you did, but maybe you did not know fully all your options that were available to you. So at least now this gives you a chance to go through and review things that you may have signed up for, to see where you may be able to move money, how you may be able to save yourself from paying on taxes, as Chris said before, and roll over 401ks versus cashing them out, and basically have additional strategies that you may not have even considered prior to.
And I'll leave you with just kind of how we've discussed how pensions have grown and decreased over the past 50 years. In 1990, 401k plans held more than $384 billion in assets. Today, the 401k plan holds more than $4.8 trillion in assets, and pensions and private sector are increasingly rare. So just look at this. This is where the money is going, though it might not always be invested in the best place. That's where you can engage with your brokerage firm on putting that money to work for you in a more strategic manner. Because if we're looking at that overall interest every year that you're losing as a result of inflation, remember, your goal is to get 2.8% growth a year at this current time. And years forward, that might be 3.5. So look to make sure that you could take more risk as you're younger. You could be a little riskier as you're not retiring for 20 years. You have time to make up gaps or errors. But if you're closer to retirement, make sure you put those in low-risk funds and indexes so you can guarantee your retirement on the time that you're ready to retire.
Well said, Chris.
And so, well, this has been Chris and Ello of Fees Always Win Investment Club, where it's not just another name, it's an insight. Good day, good night, good week. Like us on Facebook, leave a review on iTunes, and make sure if your company offers a 401k matching, do it. It's an instant 100% return on investment that's better than any stock, bond, mutual fund, or et cetera in existence. Have a good night. The opinions expressed on the show do not reflect the thoughts of our respective employers, family, or podcast network. We are not licensed by the FTC or SEC. Before acting on information on the website or from the show, you should consider whether it's suitable for your particular circumstance and seek advice from your own financial or investment advisor.
It's early morning in a suburb outside Amsterdam, and 60-year-old Josephine Lichtart is getting ready for work. She's a police officer, and after decades of work, she's just a few years away from hanging up her gun and retiring.
Ja, ik hou erg van wandelen, van fietsen.
Well, I love taking walks and biking, so I think I'm going to spend a lot of time doing things that right now I just can't do.
nu niet kan doen. Dus veel
so walking, biking, going to museums, reading books. I have a whole stack of books over there that I still want to read.
Josephine lives with her husband and daughter, and when she does retire, she will join millions of other Dutch retirees who count on generous pension payments to sustain them for the rest of their lives. The Dutch pension system is regularly ranked one of the greatest systems in the entire world. The average Dutch worker, when they retire, can expect to receive about 70% of their income paid out to them every year for the rest of their lives. And what's more, the entire country is practically covered by them. Over 90% of Dutch workers will get these pensions. Retirees in the Netherlands not only get something similar to Social Security, but they get a pension through their job. And these pensions aren't just for police and teachers and other public workers. Bakers get them, hairdressers, grocery clerks, even the staffers who sell pot in the Netherlands' infamous coffee shops get them. Each industry sets up a non-profit pension fund for its own workers. At Lauman's Butcher Shop in the heart of Amsterdam, 41-year-old Roland Otter has been working for over 20 years. With every paycheck, a bit of his salary is automatically taken out and put into a pension fund. Employees put in a little, employers put in a little more, and that money, from tens of thousands of people, invested together, builds up the fund.
Well, it's all really quite well organized. My employer pays a part of my pension, and then when I'm 65 or 67, then they'll pay it out to me. You do get a nice document overview in the mail at your house. But yeah, I read through that quickly, maybe once, and then I put it aside again. Really, I don't look into it that closely.
Frans Lauman is Roland's boss, and he says, depending on their line of work, employees have roughly 10% of their pay diverted into their pension. Lauman argues that the great feature of this system is that the savings happen effortlessly.
Well, it's really quite simple. If you get 20 euros a week extra in your hands, and you go for an extra drink, a cigarette, something extra for the kids, a bouquet of flowers for your wife, and quickly that 20 euros is gone. But if you put away 20 euros each week and do that for 40-something years of your working life, then it becomes a substantial amount.
What makes it successful is that you basically force people to save for their old age. And that, I think, is the success factor of the Dutch pension system.
Olaf Schleipen is a director at the Central Bank of the Netherlands, which helps oversee the country's pension system. Schleipen says their approach is backed up by research in behavioral economics, which tries to understand how and why people make financial decisions.
What about the argument that some Americans make, which is, I appreciate the philosophical underpinnings of the program, but don't force me. Let me have my money and figure out how I want to deal with it.
Yeah, I understand that very much. But being a human being, I think we have to realize that because our horizon is so short, you sometimes have to force yourself or basically ask somebody else. I know that I'm kind of short-sighted, that I'm myopic. Please do it for me, because if you do not force me, I know that, you know, I'm not going to do it. And that's basically how it works. It has to do with human behavior, because for somebody who's 25 or 30 or even 40, it's very abstract what will happen when you're 65.
The retirement age is going up because in the Netherlands, much like the U.S., their population is getting older. There are more retirees and they're living longer. For the Dutch, that means more payments coming out of the pension funds for longer. And also like the U.S., there are fewer young workers, so there are fewer people paying into the funds. This imbalance is only expected to accelerate. What's more, the funds themselves, many of which are invested, took a huge hit during the financial crisis, so something had to give.
In the spring of 2013, the Dutch pension funds were forced to take an unprecedented step. 66 of the country's 415 funds announced that they were going to make cuts to the payments they made to pensioners. Some of the cuts were modest, at about half of 1%. Others were steeper, at up to 7%.
Those cuts came about because Dutch law requires that pension funds have to sock away at least 105% of all their current liabilities. If a fund drops below that level, pension managers have the authority to make workers pay more or give out less to retirees.
It's this collective sharing of risk that's another hallmark of the Dutch system. Unlike public pensions in the U.S., where workers are guaranteed a set payment whether there's funds in the plan or not, or individual retirement plans like IRAs or 401ks, where each individual bears the sole risk, the Dutch have instead spread those risks and the benefits across tens of thousands of workers. That makes their system much more resilient in tough times.
Most people find pensions very boring, like mortgages. They don't think about financial stuff.
They just want it to work, but they don't want it to think about it.
They want it. It's complicated.
Ivana Hofs is the economics editor of Volkskrant, one of the biggest newspapers in the country. Hofs says, yes, the Dutch system is resilient, but she argues, despite the wishful thinking of many, these demographic challenges aren't going away anytime soon.
It's a structural thing. It's not only the crisis. And I think part of the population doesn't get it yet. They think, why do we have to lower the pensions now? Because it's only temporary. We just have to sit out the crisis and then we can go back to the old ways. But so it's an adjustment process which is very painful.
So the question becomes, to keep the system going, who exactly has to adjust? John Martens worries that, in the end, younger workers like his daughter Melanie will have to shoulder more of the burden by paying more in and getting less out.
This will be a problem for Melanie. She won't get the same money like me. And I get that money because I already build up for 30 years. So in the end, it will be okay for me. But for Melanie, it won't be enough.
He understands he may have to make adjustments to help out his daughter's generation.
If I have to pay higher pension premiums or have to receive a lower pension in order to ensure that my daughter will have a pension, then that's what has to happen.
Police officer Josephine Lichtart, just a few years from retirement, belongs to one of the pension funds that already did make a small cut to retirees.
It could be that if the crisis continues, it will have to be lowered again. That's possible. I hope not. It's less than I expected, but still it's enough. And I think I can be happy with the pension I'm going to receive.
Despite its recent troubles, it's worth remembering that the Dutch pension system is nearly 100% funded, covers a huge majority of the country, and remains a model for the rest of the world. Josephine used a common Dutch expression to reflect her realism about the future.
I just don't think that the tree can keep growing into the heavens.